So no, I think I do think the Spanish Civil War is a great example of a positive attempt, but it was positive precisely because it wasn't centered just around smashing the oppressive institutions. It was precisely centered around building the constructive project of living life in a different way.
You're listening to Professor Mark Lance speaking last month at the National Conference on Organized Resistance in Washington, D.C. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. We'll continue with the conclusion of the question and answer portion of Mark Lance's presentation.
Two-part question. Could you specify sort of the minimal criteria you would use to identify something as an oppositional and constructive project? And the second part of it is, what about the movement towards the construction of alternative institutions? Could you comment on that?
Essentially, a project is oppositional if its goal is to eliminate something and is therefore engaging in a practice that we don't envision keeping. It's inherently temporary. So if we want to, you know, smash the World Bank or end Bechtel's control over water, that's not a project that we envision in a decent society. We're not going to be fighting Bechtel because Bechtel won't be there. So it's opposing something that we're seeing as the enemy. Constructive project is building something that at least potentially we see would be part of life forever, even though, of course, I envision it'll always keep evolving. But, you know, if we're going to build a community school, well, we want a community school. We don't have a temporary goal to something else. So that, I mean, and then there'll be sub-bits where you're doing something. But that's roughly the distinction. Institutionalization is a big question, of course, for anarchists. And I think we have to institutionalize anything we do if we want it to carry on, and if we want it to transform us and make us into, you know, people that we can envision becoming. Unless you institutionalize one thing, you're never going to be able to move on to the next project if you have to keep constantly, you know, like, consciously working. We would like certain modes of interaction to become automatic, to be the kind of things that we raise our children to just, you know, we'd like to institutionalize decent treatment for a whole range of kinds of difference, so that becomes automatic in people, as opposed to what was, you know, instilled in me growing up, which was not like that. If we've got cooperative economic relations, yeah, those need to be institutionalized in a certain sense. So the key is to thinking about being an anarchist and not being opposed to institutionalization. It's not even really being opposed to authority in all the different senses of that. It's being opposed to the institutionalization of coercive authority, and so we got to figure out how we can have both things that are, you know, highly organized, highly institutional, and yet participatory. But there's been a lot written on how organizations can be that way, and it's both a big general theoretical question, but I also think it's a very contextual question, because the way you're going to institutionalize, you know, say, education for children is going to be quite different than the way you institutionalize adult education and cooking and, you know, things like that. But always the goal is to do it in a way that doesn't build in institutional coercion. You know, since I teach, I want to both train students to automatically think critically about everything that's said to them, including by me. And I want to get people to think everything I say. Is that right? You know, what, is he giving a good reason for that? You know, and I would like, you know, habits in classrooms to involve both, you know, respect and critical suspicion at the same time. And then it would be really great if the institutional structures of the university I was working in encouraged all of that systematically. They don't. And I don't expect they're going to. Maybe we could build an educational institution which did that, and then if we did that, then there'd be a way to, you know, teachers coming into it would automatically kind of gravitate towards that, because that would be part of the institutional culture. Right? Yeah.
Several of the comments and questions were about economic vision and economics, and a lot of your revolutionary historical examples were on movements that were primarily Marxist based, and it's always struck me as odd that anarchists who are ostensibly against, or, you know, smashing the state, have overlooked what Hannah Arendt called the lost treasure of the revolutionary tradition, that basically there have been throughout history spontaneous self-organization, basically direct democracy, and that idiom isn't used often, yeah. And there's often even a hostility towards the ideas of democracy within the anarchist milieu. And you yourself, I was curious what your views on it were, because you were talking about the best ideas not being necessarily the majoritarian ideas, which I agree with, but there has to be some rational basis for that. But nonetheless, how do you balance those concerns, and what do you think of that as a revolutionary demand or as an alternative to the kind of revolutionary history? Because it is about making decisions, like you said, and it's potentially more expansive.
I think democracy is a great universal rallying cry, and reclaiming that word is really, really important. And that one of the great intellectual abuses that's happened, that's crippled us, has been the equation of democracy with voting. And, you know, I agree with what some people said in the thing. If it looks tactically useful to vote in some election, vote, whatever. Sometimes I even work on a voting campaign when they're... You know, when it's not Coke versus Pepsi, but Coke versus rat poison, oh. do it. Usually that's the local elections. But voting's got next to nothing to do with democracy, you know, rule of the people, to my mind means finding structures where, I mean, ultimately decisions should be, you know, as I was saying with the philosophy department example, I think decisions should be made on the basis of, you know, the result of a conversation which comes to the conclusion that this is the right decision to make. Not that comes to the conclusion that this is the decision most people want, but that this is the right decision. But democratic rational process has got to be a process that really respects, encourages, and demands each person's intellectual full intellectual participation in that conversation. And so, you know, I mean, do I respect your views, like the argument you just made about the importance of democracy, if I say, quick, let's vote and see how many people agree with that? And as I say, look, oh, looks like the majority do, you're right. No, that's not taking your view seriously at all. That's an absurd, you know, sort of way of objectifying what you're saying. I take what you're saying seriously when I try to understand it, try to think about whether it's right, respond to it. And you know, and there's a whole lot of things to be said about what it is to really. I mean, I think one of the fundamental questions of, you know, epistemology, to use one of those big words, theory of knowledge, is what is it to take a person seriously intellectually, to respect them? Nobody, you know, so those of you who take philosophy courses, so I bet you don't see that question in your epistemology books a lot. But you know, so much the worse for your epistemology books. So yeah, I think that we do have lots of examples of spontaneous decision making. Some good, some bad, and those are what we need to think about, and we need to think about how we could take that idea of seriously, of taking seriously the opinions of everyone who's, you know, got an interest in a question, so that we could so that we could really have a community of people making calls together. But voting is going to at most be, you know, a very occasional useful thing. It's certainly not the central thing. I tell my students, my slogan I tell my students often is that voting is the opiate of the masses. We engage in this silly exercise every now and then so as to distract you from the obvious fact that you're not playing a meaningful role in the decision making that's going into to structuring your lives. But if every few years you get to go and choose between A and B, which have been handed to you, then you say, "Oh, I got to participate. Cool. I live." You know, it could be worse. I could be in an authoritarian country where I only got to choose A. And two is one more than one, so that's a lot better. Yeah.
When I hear like a constructional, and you know, about building alternative institutions, it makes me think of Butchin's idea of libertarian municipalism. Mm-hmm. I was just interested how you would comment on if you've drawn from that theory, or what do you think of that?
I've certainly learned a lot from Bookchin's writing on a lot of things, and I certainly I consider him, you know, sort of an ally in spirit in a lot of this, in the idea that, you know, we are fundamentally trying to figure out structures that we can institutionalize together that would involve a non-authoritarian way of working together. I mean, you know, it's a long conversation. There's some specific things I disagree with him about how to build those societies. And there's some of the, you know, sort of some of the philosophical ideas that he's got about what this grows out of, I disagree with, but those are neither here nor there. But you know, the short version is, yeah, it's meant to be very much kind of simpatico with that sort of approach. Sure.
Yeah. Well, personally, I hope you to say this right, because I have a lot of thoughts, but I don't know if you can get over to anything. But you said the word institution. You say the word institution. To me, freedom is a state of endless possibility. And anarchy provides us with a life that can be subjective and can provide us with a personal way to approach it. And when I hear the word institution, established institution, I think that it represses the possibility to, especially socially, approach the way our lives in a certain way. I don't know, and like you're explaining to it what anarchism is, and even that in itself to me kind of represses the possibilities of anarchy and freedom, or anarchy is freedom.
Okay, let me give you a concrete example. When my daughter was like about 3, she was watching me play chess. Some of you have heard this example, but and she said she wanted to play chess. And I said, okay, I'll teach you. And I said, the bishop, it goes diagonally like this. I'm showing her how the bishop. And she said, I want to move it here, sideways. I said, you can't. She said, yes, I can. Watch. I said, okay, you can. But if you do, you're not going to play chess. And as long as you insist on moving the bishop sideways, you're never going to play chess. And what it, you know, that's fine. You can choose not to play chess. But notice certain other things. You're never going to be able to understand chess. You're never going to be able to initiate a creative sacrifice to, you know, whatever. We'll go into chess talk here. There's a huge range of things you're never going to be able to do if you don't accept this norm that the bishop moves this way, which, you know, we can think of as an institutionalized norm. It's one we just made up. It's a habit. When you're actually playing chess, it never occurs to you to question whether the bishop moves. It's just a given. It's a structuring kind of thing. That's where freedom in general comes from. Freedom isn't having no constraints on you. Rocks have no constraints on them. No institutionalized constraints. I guess gravity and stuff, but no institutionalized constraints. They do whatever they want, which is to say precisely nothing. Freedom, positive freedom to do interesting things, only arises out of the social interactions that make there be things in the relevant sense. And those social interactions, of course, involve norms. I mean, I'm not going to come over there and punch you in the face, right? Well, it's good that we've got that habit, I take it. So I don't believe... So look, here's what is true, what I think is right. I mean, if the institutions are not freely accepted by the people involved in them, if they're run by somebody demanding of you that you have to do this, as opposed to you deciding it would be good to play chess, or it would be good to be a philosopher, or it would be good to speak English. Notice that I keep putting verbs and nouns together in certain kinds of ways. And that's pretty damned institutionalized, and it's completely invisible to you. But if we didn't, it would be hard to have a conversation, wouldn't it? It's a constraint on you, but it's a productive constraint. So the first thing is, but it's not, you know, it shouldn't be run by coercion. It shouldn't be run by someone beating you over the head. And it should never be once and for all fixed. I mean, all of our institutions need to be the sorts of things that now and then we look back at and say, gee, is there some hidden ways in which this is repressive of an important freedom, and we can revise it or change it or throw it away. We need to constantly be engaged in that process too. And that's where I see the idea that anarchism is about infinite possibilities. It's always holding open the idea that anything we're living within, anything we've constructed, we might later come back and say, that was a bad thing to construct. Damn it. Oh, shit, it never occurred to me that you could be, I don't know, heterosexist or something. I was focusing on this oppression here. Now I need to change that. We've always got to be open to that constructive project, doing that thing of spinning new and improvements on itself. But to throw away institutionalization altogether ultimately really is the green anarchy critique I was making fun of before. It's to say, well, let's just not have any rules. Well, that's to be like a rock.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I get in a lot of, fights with, like, intellectual belligerents, like people with, like, book unites or something like that. And I just think that sometimes it's kind of like this, just like this, like intellectual fascist regime, kind of. They're just enforcing this kind of, like, instituted dream. And an instituted dream in itself is horrifying, because that needs to be completely personal rather than social. And I mean, I understand collective desire, where a bunch of people find similarities in desire, but at the same time, if something differs from someone else, like if I say something different than Murray Bookchin or something like that, I just think that a lot of times it's very disrespected. For example, I mean, I identify myself as a great anarchist. And I mean,
say.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll have to talk about, you know, what that means and stuff. And if I tell you, you need to believe this because Bookchin said it, and if you don't, you're wrong. Well, yeah, that's clearly an oppressive way to go.
And that's what happens.
Well, sure it does. So those people are fine. Those people are authoritarians and need to be fought. And there you go. I agree with you. That's what's going on. On the other hand, if someone, you know, says, look, let me give you some reasons for believing this view of Bookchin's, and you don't give a shit, you say, I don't care, then you're the one who's being, you know, and even if you don't, I mean, I think you're the one who's refusing to participate in anything that deserves to be called human interaction. If you're not even willing to listen to the reasons that someone gives you, says, look, you might be doing something. I mean, how are you different from the capitalist who says, I'm not interested in your little arguments about how I might be destroying the ecosystem. I'm living my practice the way I want to. I'm the president of Exxon. I've got my practice. If you think you've got a right to tell the president of Exxon that he's doing something wrong, then you have to also say that someone else has a right to tell you that you're doing something wrong. It just doesn't make any sense that so I mean, of course you've got to believe that people can critique your behavior and that you have to think about that. It's all a matter of how they critique it. Do they critique it by giving you reasons and then taking your reasons seriously and listening to you? And if you say you're a green anarchist and you say you're caricaturing it, then I need to shut up and listen and you tell me what your view is and try to make it make sense to me.
But yeah, I mean, I'm not an immoral person. To me, in my desires and my interests, respect and mutual aid and solidarity are essential principles in my heart.
Good.
But then again, I think that just the concept of institutions create social insecurities and obligations, where out of insecurity we submit and out of obligation we respect it. And I just think that things should just be socially formed rather than like organized in institutionalized fashion. And if someone has a problem, let's say we're in a community, rather than having to compromise with it, why can't, are you all right with someone just leave the community? Seeing how
that's a possible solution sometimes. Not always, though.
I mean, we're talking all prefigurative dream terms, but still.
Well, I mean, it depends on the kind. Sometimes leaving is possible. Sometimes it isn't.
The coercive authority.
Well, mind you, I'm not opposed even to coercive authority. I think there's some things that we should. Again, remember, we're revolutionary people. I mean, don't we want to coerce the capitalists?
Intimidate.
Huh? Well, coercion means making somebody do something that they don't want to do. You make them do it without convincing them. We want to do that. I take it everybody in this room wants to coerce some people into not doing certain evil shit. And even if we got, you know, our wonderful society, there'd occasionally be crazy-ass people that I'm going to coerce, you know. If somebody's, you know, raping my friend, I'm going to stop them any way I can. And if I can't convince them, I'm going to punch them in the face. Or hopefully get somebody who's good at punching in the face to do it. I mean, I'm a philosopher. But that's coercion. The key for the anarchist is not institutionalizing the coercion. Don't say, well, what we need is for somebody who's good at punching in the face to be the cop, and then we'll make that a habit of that. So it's only it's when coercion is institutionalized that I think there's a problem. It's not institutionalism per se, and it's not even coercion per se, because sometimes we decide that the thing we need to do is coerce somebody to stop doing something that's destructive. It's when you institutionalize habits of coercion that you're on the way toward building a society that's based around those structures and doesn't see coercion as an unfortunate thing that we have to do here now to fight this particular thing we need to oppose. But are we supposed to stop now? What time is this supposed to end? I just have no idea what the schedule is. Okay, cool. Yeah.
All this is somewhat fairly new to me, but when you're talking about the idea of freedom, I was on the internet a couple years back and I was looking at guy by the name of Hakeem Bey.
Yeah, yeah.
And talking about a temporary autonomous zone.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit in your relation to freedom?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, first of all, he's the funniest anarchist that ever lived. But the idea of, I mean, a temporary autonomous zone is sometimes in him comes out of a sort of pessimism about the possibility of ever really changing things. You know, the sort of sense, look, society's always going to be massively oppressive. And the best we can do is, you know, this afternoon, let's have, you know, this thing be free in this park here, or something like that. Maybe it can last a week, and then it goes away, and we do it. I'm not pessimistic that way, but I think in a certain sense, there's something right about the opportunistic idea of, well, look, if we can do, you know, whatever it is, if we can do childcare in this neighborhood in a free and inclusive and empowering way for a month, do it. But I'm not, you know, a priori pessimistic. I think, well, and then while you're doing it, think about ways you might link it up with something free someone else is doing in some other zone and make something lasting. I mean, I think, you know, that my hope is that enough of those temporary autonomous practices can ultimately link together into being something recognizably like a long-term autonomous life. So that I mean, I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I think I have no idea whether we're going to succeed in any of this or not. And I think anyone who thinks they can predict something this complicated is just silly. But why the hell not try? I mean, at least we'll have fun hanging together and trying. Yeah.
Sorry, I missed parts of the discussion, but I just had a response to your thing about change through coercion. And while I think, you know, like Frederick Douglass says, power concedes nothing without demand, I'm not sure that coerced change or coercing changes in behavior ultimately makes for a social change that's going to mean anything. I think I don't believe that political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. I think political power comes out of the ability to define a situation. And I think that real long-term social change can only come from change in consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so having tools that make it possible to change consciousness, and that, you know, is different than having the coercive ability to change behavior.
That's right.
And I think there are two different approaches, and I think the second is also inherently more democratic than the first.
Absolutely.
And, you know, not just arguing from a pacifist perspective, but I'm just saying in terms of really, and I think it's a frustration with being able to change someone's mind that leads you to think about blowing their head off.
Absolutely.
But I think, you know, to be creative in a way, I mean, that really ultimately that's more, we have more power if we understand that tool in this, especially in this well-armed society, than we do trying to form some sort of a violent or militia response to it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said. First of all, the question of coercion is, to my mind, completely separate from the question of violence. A huge amount of nonviolent change is nonetheless coercive. I mean, if we have a strike against the grocery store or we boycott grapes, we're coercing the grape owners into changing their behavior. We're not convincing them that it would be the right thing to do. We're coercing them. So let's.
It might be both.
Well, it might be, but it's coercive. Let's be clear about that. You know, boycotting somebody and making it the case that they're going to lose their business if they don't behave better is coercion. So violence versus nonviolence, and you know, of the two, I actually think that I'm not an absolute pacifist. I think there are contexts in which one needs to use violence, but there's a lot fewer of those than most people think, in my view, and there's deep ways in which nonviolence is always more transformative than violence. So I agree with a lot of that. I also believe that what you said, I mean, a lot of what I'm saying is that ultimately the change has to also be changes in consciousness as well as changes in institutions that reinforce one another. And so precisely, coercion is never going to make for fundamental change. Absolutely. It's not going to fundamentally change the institutions of society. But that doesn't mean you never coerce, even as part of a project of fundamentally changing institutions of society, because one of the things might be, look, if we don't stop this person from dumping toxins into this river in the next month, we're all going to be dead, and we're not going to fundamentally change anything, so we're going to make them stop it. And if that means, you know, even blowing up their factory, if that's the only way to do it, well, we might have to do that in some, I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, I mean, I think of, you know, think of things like the ANC's campaign of economic sabotage. I think they made very subtle and sophisticated arguments for that. Those are contextual questions of what you have to do. But there will be, in the oppositional project in which we're getting the boots off of necks so as to be able to fundamentally change society, we're going to have to be coercive in some parts of that. Hopefully, yeah, you even when you are coercive, you do it along with a campaign of education and respect. And, you know, I mean, you think of things like what Barbara Deming says of, yeah, on the one hand, I've got one hand forcing you to do something, and I've got another hand held out and offering you a way to interact with me in a different mode. And one of her views about the power of nonviolence is that you can at the same time hold both those hands out, whereas if I'm shooting you, I can't. Again, I mean, I think there are very limited cases in which people have had to shoot people.
Well, Emma offered to help nurse Frick, you know, after...
there's a whole lot of things Emma did in that period which we might want to rethink. But yeah, anyway, so...
This has been a recording of Mark Lance on Anarchist Practice, Rational Democracy, and Community.
He spoke at the National Conference on Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 25, 2004.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. Since last October, I've been reading weekly installments from a book, Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. We took a break in our readings last week in order to bring you a remarkable town hall on Iraq in its entirety. This week, we'll resume our readings of Disciplined Minds with Chapter 12, which is titled Neutral Voices. If you're joining the program for the first time, in the book Disciplined Minds, the author, Jeff Schmidt, has been making the case that professional work, as it is performed in our society, is fundamentally ideological, and that the training system of graduate schools and professional schools that prepare people for careers, in addition to the technical skills normally associated with professional work, serve as a way to gatekeep entry into the professions. Schmidt asserts that the system of professional training, above all, strives to create graduates who will accept the ideological discipline of whoever employs them, and who will be happy putting their talents at the service of the status quo. This training system, which is seen as neutral, is actually deeply biased toward the social hierarchies that presently exist. So, Chapter 12, Neutral Voices. Where's the red one? Who can tell me where it is for 60? The operator of an illegal street hustle known as Three-Card Monty tries to engage someone in the crowd, but none of the midtown Manhattan pedestrians who stop to watch the action responds. Here, he says, turning over the card that everyone knew was the red one. Watch it now. He turns the card face down again and slowly interchanges it with the other two cards on his makeshift table, fashioned from a couple of discarded cardboard boxes. Where is it now? Tell me for 60, he says, peeling off 320s from a wad of bills. Who saw it? Anybody? You. Do you know where it is? He asks a man in the crowd. The man hesitates. Just point to it. Just point to it. For free. Go ahead, urges the dealer, trying to hook the mark. The man points to a card. There is little doubt that it is the red one, because the dealer, openly frustrated with the crowd's reticence, had moved the cards at baby speed this time, just to get people to start playing the game. Show me 60 and you're a winner, says the dealer to the man, offering him the opportunity to fill in the skipped step of betting by simply displaying the $60 that he would have bet. The man need not actually hand over the money, because the winner always gets his bet back anyway, along with his winnings. The game's rules, it seems, are bigger than both the dealer and the player, and so the dealer must ask the player to at least go through the motions of placing a bet. Show me 60, repeats the dealer, in a tone of someone obliged to walk a beginner through the steps of the game. Show it to him, show it to him, advise two knowledgeable-sounding people in the crowd in excited whispers, encouraging the mark to seize the opportunity and win $60. The mark is a bit bewildered. Everything seems to be happening so fast, but he tries to appear like he knows what he's doing. He pulls out his wallet, removes $60, and shows it to the dealer. The dealer reaches out to receive the money, as if it were being handed to him, but the mark hesitates. I have to hold it, says the dealer. The mark doesn't want to disrupt things now that he's just moments away from collecting his winnings. With his mind on the $60 that he's going to get, he decides to view the dealer's request as just another rule. It's only for a few seconds anyway, he thinks, as he hands his $60 to the dealer. Turn over the red one, invites the dealer, gesturing toward the cards. The mark slides the red card to the edge of the table and flips it face up. But wait a minute. It's black. Ah, damn, yell the mark's two self-appointed advisors, showing sympathy, but in the process implying that this is a legitimate outcome. Stunned and disoriented, the mark is struggling to figure out what's been going on. You took my money, he says quietly, apparently thinking out loud. And then with greater confidence, you took my money. A bet's a bet, the dealer starts to explain. You took my money, give it back, interrupts the stung mark, who now appears to be on the verge of using force. A heated exchange of words ensues, and there seems to be no way that one man or the other can prevail through talk alone. Then someone in the crowd says, you lost, man. These words seem to work a kind of magic on the mark, who suddenly appears to have lost full confidence in his own position. For the first time, he allows himself to consider accepting the situation as it stands, perhaps by viewing it as the words from the crowd suggest, as his loss of a fair game, rather than as his victimization by the dealer. The same words, you lost, man, had they come from the dealer himself, might have been further provocation. But coming from a nonpartisan, neutral, disinterested source, they are persuasive. To finish cooling out the mark, the dealer offers a consolation prize that actually has some value, but he links this offer explicitly to the mark getting on with his day. I'll give you a free chance to win 20, so you can have a nice day, says the dealer. The mark, no longer making any demands, watches the dealer deploy the cards and interchange them a few times. At the dealer's signal, the mark reaches out and turns over what should be the red card, but isn't. Oh! Exclaim the two vocal people in the crowd. And the mark walks away, disappearing quickly into the busy pedestrian traffic. The dealer resumes his work immediately, giving himself the professional look of a casino employee who doesn't stop to react emotionally to the outcome of the game. But before he can hook another mark, a lookout stationed up the block spots a cop and motions back to the table. In an instant, the dealer is a pedestrian, floating inconspicuously down the street. The boxes and cards that he has abandoned suddenly look like ordinary trash left out on the sidewalk for collection, and the people in the crowd go on their way. But look, look who the dealer is walking with. You guessed it. It's the two people who advised the mark. In fact, they are the ones whose flamboyant winning and losing had attracted the crowd in the first place. They always won in a way that made you think, that was easy, I could have done that, and lost in a way that made you think, that was stupid. I could have won that one easily. And they are the ones who spoke up at the con game's three critical junctures, at the hook, encouraging the mark to go ahead and show 60, at the sting, saying damn at the black card, to frame the operation as a fair game rather than as trickery, and at the cool out, encouraging the mark to view the outcome as his own failure by saying you lost instead of he misled you. I witnessed this scene during my lunch hour one day and have tried to recount it here as accurately as possible. Yes, the streetwise hustler really did say, so you can have a nice day. In fact, I've seen this game, a variation on the age-old shell game, many times on New York City sidewalks, and it's pretty much the same every time. I watch these games in part because the people who operate them often display impressive insight into the way people think and show great sophistication in their use of psychology. Surely their intuition and skill would make the typical professional psychologist look dull in comparison. Watching the shills is especially instructive. The dealer could certainly engage some marks without the shills' help, but he wouldn't survive for very long without their protection. It's easier to get a person to believe a false promise than it is to get the person to accept a loss. And when the game moves from the former stage to the latter, the operator's personal authority by itself is no longer sufficient to manipulate the mark. Thus, the operator has his neutral voices. For the operator of the game, getting the mark to go peacefully is a necessity, not an option, and so cooling out is not something that happens after the game. Cooling out is an integral part of the game. There are lessons here that go far beyond the game itself. In 1952, sociologist Irving Goffman wrote a paper in the journal Psychiatry showing that many institutions, authority figures, and ordinary individuals in legitimate society engage in activity that is essentially the same as that of the con artist cooling out the mark. In fact, as educational sociologist Burton R. Clark later showed, cooling out is one of the main social functions of institutions of higher education in the United States. The U.S. socioeconomic system, like the hustler, makes false promises, the principal one being that social mobility is available to all who work hard. By its very nature, a hierarchical system cannot possibly keep such a promise. The number of positions at successively higher levels decreases very quickly and is always less than the number of hard-working people who want the positions. This structure sets many ambitious workers on a collision course with the reality of limited opportunity. When they are finally hit with the tragic disappointment, they may become angry or resentful, and so the hierarchical system must engage in widespread cooling out. It does this not only to protect its agents who stand at the gate and do the dirty work of exclusion, but also to make sure that those who have been disappointed do not become opponents of the hierarchical system itself and enemies of its power elite. It is vital to the system that the losers serve the hierarchy respectfully and not sabotage it when they find themselves with jobs that have lower social status than the society of unlimited opportunity had led them to expect. Cooling out is therefore an integral part of the socioeconomic system. Those who say, "That's life," should understand that there is nothing natural about a system that kills the spirit of large numbers of people by first putting them in a position where they need opportunity, then promising them virtually unlimited opportunity, and finally making them losers. The hierarchical system itself does create much of the need for opportunity in the first place. Its hierarchical division of labor, in which the interesting and creative parts of work are separated out and reserved for a few, while the tedious and mind-dulling parts are heaped on the many, has a lot of people wishing for better jobs. And its hierarchy of authority, in which decision-making power is concentrated at the top, has a lot of people wishing for jobs where they have some say, or at the very least, insulation from those above them, autonomy. If jobs were designed in a way that did not force people to specialize in the uninspiring parts of work, and if decisions in the workplace were made democratically rather than by a hierarchy of bosses, two of the main goals that drive individuals to seek opportunity would already be met: more fulfilling work and a fair share of power. As the avenues for getting ahead in this country have narrowed, the route of formal education has become dominant, so that today the pursuit of opportunity in the United States is to a large extent institutionalized in the colleges. As a result, the colleges have become one of the pyramidal system's main tools for cooling out people's unrealistic career ambitions. They do it on a massive scale, yet by necessity conceal the fact that that is what they are doing. The process of cooling out students' high educational and career expectations begins, of course, long before college. Grades from high school teachers and advice from counselors have an effect, but it's easy to base your hopes and plans on the thought that these people are underestimating you. Their reactions to you have always been very subjective, after all. So perhaps their professional assessments, too, contain errors of judgment due to misimpressions, personality conflicts, personal prejudices, and so on. But then comes the big aptitude test. And a few weeks later, when you open the envelope and look at your scores, you feel like you are really looking at a true picture of yourself. The SAT and ACT scores have a powerful impact on the self-images of students, and those whose self-images are hit hard lower their expectations. They may not even apply to the colleges that they most want to attend. For most students, college itself means further cooling out. The lower the social status of the college, the greater its orientation toward wrapping up the formal education of its students. In fact, cooling out competes with remedial instruction to be the raison d'etre of the community or junior college. These two-year institutions, which take in 2/3 of a million graduating high school seniors every year, allow large numbers of people to, quote, go to college and get it over with post-haste. Today, we're playing more of that winnowing function, says George Prather, an official in the 100,000-student Los Angeles Community College District. Nationwide, most students going from high school into two-year colleges plan to transfer to four-year colleges or universities where they can earn bachelor's degrees. In the end, however, a large majority of transfer program students either switch to a terminal program or leave college altogether. Each year, only about 5% of those enrolled in two-year colleges transfer to bachelor's-granting institutions, an astoundingly small fraction. For example, Los Angeles City College in the 1997-98 school year managed to transfer only 481 of its 15,000 students to the California State University system, and just 73 students to the more prestigious University of California system. Statewide, California's 106 community colleges, which constitute the largest system of higher education in the world, open the year with 1,143,000 students. By the year's end, 56,000 had transferred to the California State University or University California systems, and 1,087,000 had not. Clark analyzed the process by which junior colleges change transfer students into terminal students. He considers, as an example, a student who wants to be an engineer, but who is not destined to be one. What might be the sequence of experiences that cools him out? At many junior colleges, these experiences start even before classes do, in the form of testing and counseling. Thus, after an enrollment examination in English and mathematics, our would-be engineer may find himself in remedial classes, which delay his eventual transfer to a four-year college, and more importantly, shake his self-image as a future engineer. At a required advising session, a counselor looks over his counseling folder, which contains transcripts from other schools, test scores, recommendations from teachers, and so on. Although his file is thin, the counselor observes that high school grades and test scores such as these usually suggest a less ambitious program. But of course, you're free to go ahead and try the pre-engineering program if you want. Just remember that we have a lot of really good vocational programs here, too. The student will face this folder again and again as the months go by, and as grades and need for improvement notices from instructors accumulate. The file of impersonal, objective-looking data shadows him, and when it grows sufficiently strong, it will stalk him. The counselors, skilled in handling the overambitious student, use the growing file to justify becoming more persistent with their advice. Advice given at previous counseling sessions is in the student's folder and is now cited impersonally as part of the accumulating evidence. The counselors edge the student toward a vocational program, but they never countermand his choices. for the whole point of the protracted exercise is to avoid a personal hard no and have the student make the correct choice on his own. Finally, the student is put on academic probation for receiving below average grades and must now submit to more than the usual amount of counseling. Students are allowed to stay on probation for a number of semesters or indefinitely, depending on the school. So probation does not force many students out of junior college. Rather, it is designed to get the student to think about himself and admit to his thinking the possibility of reclassifying himself as a terminal student. Reclassification would allow him to receive the college's 2-year degree, Associate in Arts, by putting him in classes in which he would get grades high enough to bring his average up to the required level. He relents at last and reclassifies himself, marking a big change in his life. The college expedites changes of this sort by making them appear as small as possible. Our student will be an engineering aide instead of an engineer. There's a world of difference, of course, but on the surface things appear pretty much the same. He continues as a student, at least for the time being, and he tells his families that he has decided to start out as an engineering aide. The junior college's cooling out work, like all cooling out work, is necessarily hidden. When it isn't hidden, there is no cooling out. In fact, when attempts to cool out people become apparent, they backfire badly. Seen as attempts at manipulation, they provoke anger and heat things up. The junior colleges, in spite of their actual function, are widely thought of as transfer stations for students on their way to bachelor's degrees. If these institutions were to get a reputation among high school students and their families as dead-end sidetracks for losers in the paper chase, many students would refuse to go to them. The pyramidal system, which uses formal education to allocate scarce opportunity, would have to find some other way of cooling out the excessive, quote-unquote, number of students who want bachelor's degrees. The 4-year institutions themselves, with their dropout rate already at 50%, would be reluctant to help by increasing their share of the cooling out action. Many students who do get bachelor's degrees want to work toward a professional credential such as a law degree, medical degree, or PhD. As we have seen, the criteria that determine who is permitted to do this include attitude, and in particular favor individuals who have the kind of uncritical attitude or narrow focus that makes them easy to direct. But it is not enough for the qualification system to give the best positions to those who will do the best jobs from the point of view of employers. It must also cool out the high educational and career expectations of those who are excluded, including those who would do the best job from other points of view, such as that of clients and the public. Professional qualifying examinations help to do both. Not only do they help identify those who would serve employers best, but they also help cool out the, quote, failures. Failures are not a waste product of the educational system, but are carefully produced. At every level of the paper chase, those who don't get credentials are comparable in numbers to those who do. And so the losers cannot simply be given the brush off. The system must shut them out without turning them into enemies, because they are to become a large part of the workforce. To get them to work hard, if not enthusiastically, on jobs with lower than hoped for social status, and to get them to do so without having to give them more control over the content of the work and over the workplace, the system must make sure that those weeded out feel they have been treated fairly. Those who fail, just like those who pass, must feel well matched to their station in the social hierarchy of production, and an impersonal, objective-looking examination is a very persuasive matchmaker. A good example of such a matchmaker is the big qualifying examination that sends graduate students either on to the PhD or out of graduate school. Although the rest of this chapter focuses exclusively on the faculty written professional qualifying examination, most of the discussion applies to qualifying examinations in general, including standardized pre-professional qualifying tests, such as the SAT and the ACT, and standardized professional qualifying tests, such as the LSAT, MCAT, and GRE. The examination's cooling out power, like the cooling out power of the voice in the crowd and the material in the counseling folder, comes from its nonpartisan image. The fact that the exam strongly favors particular values and attitudes must, like the affiliation of the shill and the socioeconomic goals of the junior college, remain hidden. The nature of the test must appear to be dictated purely by the subject itself, and not at all by consideration of the kind of obedience that employers want in a specialist. Students faced with dismissal will seize upon any point in the evaluation system that they find unfair. Clearly, the qualification system would not work very well if students saw the exam in part as a probe of their attitudes and values. If students perceived the political element, the test would be no more persuasive than a faculty member saying, "We don't like you." Accusations of bias would certainly follow, making a public issue of the system's notion of what kind of person makes the best professional, and forcing the educational institution to debate its notion openly, and in the process, to reveal not only its politics, but also, and more importantly, the very fact that it has politics. As it is, students generally do not perceive the political element and therefore are led to confront themselves instead of the institution. The exam's squeaky clean image makes the crucial difference between the messy kicking out and the peaceful cooling out of those not wanted by the system. The test's nonpartisan look transforms it from a tool of the institution into an independent third party, allowing the institution to maintain a purely positive image. The institution is set up to produce successes. It is the test that forces denial. Modern personnel record keeping in general has the function of documenting for denial, notes Clark. When faculty members judge a student negatively and crush the student's hope of becoming a professional in the field, they use the test to distance themselves emotionally from what they are doing and to avoid feeling personally responsible for their decision. Yes, the faculty members write the test, administer it, score it, and report the results. But in doing each of these things, they see themselves as clerical workers, not as judges. It is the nonpartisan third party that judges the student. Faculty members are generally sympathetic, but detached, as the neutral third party snuffs out the student's aspirations in a clean, mechanical, businesslike way. Qualification systems almost always allow for repeated attempts at success and repeated occasion for failure. The student has the right to retake the qualifying examination even when the faculty doesn't encourage the student to do so. This right to try again is always presented in terms of the opportunity it provides, not in terms of its main purpose, which is to let down the hopes of the unwanted slowly, rather than in one abrupt, alienating, and potentially explosive step. When the students are failed for the first time, they begin to admit thoughts of revising their goals. By the time the exam comes around again, they are more prepared to accept its judgment of their ability to learn the tricks of the trade. The faculty is more persuasive this time, now that it is backed up by another piece of, quote, objective evidence. The facts get increasingly hard for the student to explain away. Students whose attitudes and values clash with those of the faculty are obviously at a disadvantage when the faculty meets after the examination and considers the whole student. But they are also at a disadvantage on the examination itself. These students come away from the test feeling frustrated. They feel that the test didn't give them an opportunity to show much of what they could do in the subject, but instead focused on a narrow range of skills. The test's focus within the subject, of course, is dictated not by the subject itself, but by the faculty's attitudes and values, and so these lie at the heart of the student's frustration with the test. However, most students who feel that the exam is underestimating them never manage to get to the heart of the problem. They grope for an understanding of why they failed, but end up offering explanations that they themselves don't find satisfactory. I didn't do my best work. The questions were unusually difficult. I ran out of time. I wasn't feeling well. Such explanations, which are the best that students can come up with when they don't question the neutrality of the test, do have a bit of credibility after the first test. You won't hear them after the second test, though. Even when students do figure out that attitudes and values play a key role in qualification, and even when they also feel that their own conflict of outlook with the faculty has tipped the balance against them, they hesitate to protest. There are two reasons for their timidity. First, they have no way to prove the conflict of outlook has made any difference. Second, trying to get ready for the all-encompassing examination has left them in a state of very low self-confidence. Because the test knows no bounds, the more students study for it, the more they discover they don't know. Students go into the marathon examination feeling unsure of themselves and come out of it ready to believe just about anything the faculty tells them about how well they did. The student who has failed, of course, suffers an even further reduction in self-confidence. Maybe I'm not really good enough, thinks the student. Maybe the faculty is right and I'm just making excuses. In the end, even the most perceptive students may be unable to speak out. Students who are willing and able to conform to the faculty's attitudes and values, which usually favor the status quo over social change, are less likely than others to get cooled out of professional training. They're also less likely to go on to challenge the field's role in the status quo or the status quo in the field. Among those who do get cooled out, individuals who would be uncompromising advocates for clients and the public, but a lot of trouble for employers, are overrepresented. This cleansing of the ranks is a great loss not only to the individuals involved, but to society as well. Indeed, the biggest losers in the game of professional qualification are not those shut out of professional careers, but working people in general, who are deprived of the allies they would have in the professional ranks if the politics of professional qualification were different. And I've been reading from Chapter 12 of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. If you'd like to find out more about the book or the author, you can visit disciplinedminds.com. And if you'd like to hear readings of previous chapters you may have missed, you can visit our archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.